This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Liz Pelka. Thousands of people have taken to the streets in Russia to demand the release of jailed Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny. And now, thousands of arrests. Russian police have detained more than 3,000 protesters Sunday, according to OVD Info, a monitoring organization. Authorities mounted a massive effort to stop the demonstrations after tens of thousands of people rallied across the country last weekend in the most widespread show of discontent in Russia in years. Navalny, an anti-corruption activist, was jailed immediately after returning to his home country in mid-January after recovering abroad from a poison attack. He has blamed his poisoning on the Kremlin, which has been denied. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken addressed the protests on Twitter Sunday. He condemned the, quote, persistent use of harsh tactics against peaceful protesters and journalists by Russian authorities for a second week. Reports from Somalia's capital, Mogadishu, say a huge explosion has happened near a popular hotel on the road to the airport. Witnesses say the massive blast occurred near Hotel Afrique, a popular hotel near a busy security checkpoint to the Mogadishu airport. Initial reports say suspected al-Shabaab gunmen stormed the hotel and a fierce exchange of gunfire between security forces and gunmen was taking place inside. A team of World Health Organization scientists continue their coronavirus investigation in Wuhan, China, Sunday, visiting the wet market believed to be the source of the virus in late 2019. We're following this story on voanews.com. Go there for the latest. This is VOA News. A group of 10 moderate Republican U.S. senators are urging President Joe Biden to reconsider his $1.9 trillion COVID-19 relief package. In a letter to the president, the group said they wanted to meet to discuss a compromise that they believe could win swift bipartisan support. The senators, which include Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, Mitt Romney, and others, said they would unveil their plan on Monday. The progress of Biden's package to support individuals and businesses will be an early test of the new U.S. president's promise to work across the political divide. The Associated Press reports Israel has agreed to transfer 5,000 doses of coronavirus vaccine to the Palestinians for frontline medical workers. Israel has been criticized for not providing vaccines to the Palestinians before, but says it is not responsible for them. International troops plan to stay in Afghanistan beyond the May deadline that was originally hoped for by the insurgent Taliban's deal with the United States. Four senior NATO officials confirmed the plan, a move that could escalate tensions with the Taliban demanding full withdrawal. One official told Reuters anonymously, conditions have not been met. Meanwhile, a member of the Afghan government's peace negotiating team warned the Taliban that if they don't resume peace talks soon, the government could recall the team before a deal is reached. Government negotiator Rasul Talib said in a press conference, the team is waiting for the return of the Taliban leadership to Doha, Qatar, where a second round of peace talks began this month. However, little progress has been made. There was no immediate response from the Taliban. Former President Trump has parted ways with his lead impeachment lawyers just over a week before his trial begins. That's according to two people familiar with the situation who spoke to the Associated Press on Saturday. The change injects fresh uncertainty into the makeup and strategy of President Trump's defense team. One person described the lawyer's departure as a mutual decision. President Trump is set to stand trial on the week of February 8th on a charge that he incited the riot inside the U.S. Capitol. Many Parisians expressed their relief after French Prime Minister announced stronger curfew measures, but no new lockdown on that lockdown at night. Via remote, I'm Liz Pelka, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
An act of cowardice and injustice, and that would not go to court to first of all undertake this exposure of what we believe are gross failings by the country's independent commission.
A Ugandan opposition party plans to file a petition at the Supreme Court to challenge the results of the elections Monday.
We're hearing singular statements from one man who does not have the capacity or the know-how or the ability to advise us on something as complex as a pandemic. It comprises of many voices.
A Tanzanian rights activist says President John Magufuli's statements are unhelpful in the fight to limit the spread of the coronavirus.
Some people, because of our very rigorous scrutiny at airport, might decide to use other ports of entry. We just want to make sure that there's no hiding place for anybody. There are no escape routes, because President Bill treats the lives and livelihood of Sierra Leoneans as a key priority of his administration.
And Sierra Leonean Information Minister says the imposition of a two-week lockdown aims to combat the spread of the novel coronavirus in the West African country. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Uganda, the main opposition National Unity Platform, or NUP, plans to legally challenge the outcome of the recent elections Monday. Citing voter irregularities and rigging, the party rejected the results of the elections. Robert Kyagulanyi Ssentamu, known as Bobi Wine, the presidential candidate of the party, insists he defeated incumbent President Yoweri Museveni in the presidential vote. The Ugandan Electoral Commission declared Museveni winner of the presidential election with 58.64% of the votes. Main challenger Bobi Wine came in second with 34.83%. Mathias Mpuuga is a deputy president of the party and a leading member of the NUP legal team. He tells me the opposition party has strong evidence it will show in court that the elections were rigged.
Yes, very true. We announced yesterday officially that we would challenge the election outcomes in the Supreme Court of Uganda. And by today, we're ready to actually file. But we're advised by the Supreme Court registrars that we would file on Monday, which is an official working day. Although in these kind of situations, every day is considered a working day. But we did comply, and we shall therefore wait until Monday and file up.
Do you think the evidence you have by which you will be basing your argument on to challenge the outcome of the elections are overwhelming enough that will change what was declared by the Ugandan Electoral Commission?
You know, I'll tell you that in this petition, two institutions actually are on trial. One is the Electoral Commission, headed by a justice of the Uganda Constitutional Court. And then two, the judicial system itself in Uganda under challenge, because this will be, I think, the third kind of petition filed in the last 20 years in Uganda of a botched election. And for all the time this has come up, the court have been very clear that these elections were actually irregular. But then they came short of calling them, because the claim was that the irregularities were not substantive enough to affect the outcome. Now, here we are in a situation where the fraud, the irregularities were all over the world to see from day one, from the day our candidate was nominated. If the courts believe that these kind of acts that took place, including blocking our candidate from campaigning, arresting him several times, killing and arresting his campaign team members represents a free and fair election, then suddenly they would have enriched our jurisprudence in their understanding of fairness.
Well, but Matthias, some Ugandans I spoke with are of the view that the path you are taking is a waste of time because there's no precedent in Uganda for that, and that people are aware that President Museveni won fair and square, and that some of the inconsistencies or voter irregularities you talked about might not necessarily be enough.
You know, our laws are very clear on what would constitute an irregularity, and we are content with the fact that the gross violations of the election guidelines, the violations of the rights of the candidates, the abuse of the entire process, including ballot stuffing on record, the video recording of ballot stuffing, are substantive enough for a judicial system that is independent to actually annul the election. We will do what we believe is in our stride and space to expose what we believe was irregular. And we shall invite the justices to believe with us that actually, in a free and democratic society, there's no way you can run an election and call it free and fair, regardless of the final outcome. When in a contest, one of the contestants is actually on chains, and then you come out and say, well, whereas he was on chains for 30 days, the campaign was for 60 days. It will actually be something we want to put on record that in this fair world, a group of judicial officers believe that where there is murder, that kind of competition is still free and fair.
What are the prospects of your case at the Supreme Court?
We are buoyed by the fact that every court sets a strong record, and we are not about to go by the record of the previous courts and their occupants. We believe that the Supreme Court has had a breath of new life with fresh members of the bench. And we actually took time to take the decision to go to court because we are alive to all these limitations. Should we proceed to go to court without putting on scale the versatility of our evidence? And we believe that we've done enough to put this evidence on the scale, and we find it overwhelming. And it would be an act of cowardice and injustice that we do not go to court to, first of all, undertake this exposure of what we believe are gross failings by the country's supposed independent commission.
Matthias Mpuuga is a deputy president of the Ugandan Opposition Party National Unity Platform, or NUP. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. A prominent Tanzanian human rights activist is calling on citizens to protect themselves against the coronavirus. Fatma Karume, who is also a former president of the Tanganyika Law Society, says President John Magufuli's statement about the disease have been unhelpful in the effort to combat the disease in the East African country. Her remarks come after the president expressed doubt about the efficacy of the vaccine against the coronavirus. She praised the Catholic Church in Tanzania for calling on parishioners to protect themselves against the disease. Ms. Karume tells me Tanzanians must practice universally accepted protocols, including mask wearing, social distancing, and hand washing to help stop the spread of the disease.
You know, Peter, the most fascinating aspect of authoritarianism or dictatorship is the ease with which one man, and let's face it, Peter, more often than not, it is a man rather than a woman, the ease with which one man can shut out the voices of millions of people in favor of his own, irrespective of the absurdity of his thinking and his own voice. In a pandemic, I have come to realize that actually a dictatorship does not need military prowess to put mankind at risk. He need only refuse to accept the existence of the pandemic and refuse to vaccinate 60 million people. And he proceeds to wage biological warfare against the world.
Fatma, where do Tanzanians go from here? Particularly hearing news from the outside world, neighboring countries about the rising coronavirus infection, second wave, people dying, yet the stance of the government appears to be different. Where do they go from here?
Tanzanians have two choices. They either put their lives in the hands of a government that is clearly incompetent and does not really care about their health, or they take care of their health. And I think what Tanzanians have to decide is that their lives are in their hands, because they sure are not in the hands of the government, and the government doesn't care enough about their lives. So my advice to Tanzanians is take care of yourselves, follow the protocol for this pandemic.
But Fatma, the president has made a recent statement about the vaccine, that health experts should not be in a haste to prescribe vaccine for the people in Tanzania. How do they combat the disease from the stance of the government?
Peter, I think the president's actual statement was more profound than that. He denigrated the entire world system of inoculating. He actually said that if inoculations worked, then we wouldn't have TB and we wouldn't have HIV, forgetting entirely that actually we do have inoculation against TB. It's called BCG, and every Tanzanian actually is given a BCG vaccination. So my concern is that his statement does not only denigrate the COVID inoculation, it goes deeper than that. It denigrates even inoculations that we are all accustomed to taking, and it's making our whole public health system, which is based on childhood inoculations, not viable. Or let's put it this way, it's leading people to mistrust these inoculations. And what is frightening is he bases the mistrust on race. He actually says that it is the white man's inoculations that don't work. So this is really frightening for me.
Fatma, does the episcopal pronouncement or statement sharply clashes with that of the stance of the government and by extension, President Magufuli, being a Catholic or professes to be a Catholic himself?
I think the episcopal statement is extremely important, and they stepped up to the challenge. The Catholic Church in Tanzania is the only religious organization that dared to step up to the challenge and start informing their congregation that there is a pandemic and that they have to take care. Now, whether this is in sharp contrast to Magufuli, I think is obvious. It clearly is in sharp contrast. And I'm grateful to the Catholic Church. Long live they to do the right thing.
Fatma, would you rather Tanzanians listen to the Catholic Church or listen to the government mandated by the Constitution to take care of them during this pandemic and beyond?
There has been no statement from the government. The statements have been coming from one man, the president. We're hearing singular statements from one man who does not have the capacity or the know-how or the ability to advise us on something as complex as a pandemic. It comprises of many voices.
Fatma Karume is a former president of the Tanganyika Law Society. She spoke with me from the Tanzanian commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. Sierra Leone's information minister says the government has imposed a lockdown to limit the spread of the coronavirus. Mohamed Rahman Souare says the action forms part of the administration's effort to stem the tide of the second wave of the disease. The government imposed a two-week initial lockdown in the capital, Freetown. This following a surge in cases of infection of the coronavirus. The lockdown includes a night curfew in other parts of the country. Restaurants and bars are also affected by the move. To learn more about the lockdown and other measures the administration in Freetown is implementing to stop the spread of the disease, I reached Sierra Leonean Information Minister Mohamed Rahman Souare.
We officially commence a series of actions, including partial lockdown of the western area, to stem the tide of the COVID-19 pandemic. It could be recalled that as a result of the stringent measures and the strong leadership provided by President Biu, this country has been globally commended for the leadership in managing the COVID-19. We do not want to get our eyes off the ball. That is why these measures have come into place.
Mohamed, some Sierra Leoneans expressed concern that there is still misconception and misinformation about the existence of coronavirus in Sierra Leone. Some people are still doubtful. What is your government doing to help, you know, educate the masses about the existence of the disease and the second wave as it is now?
Like it is all over the world. You have people who hardly believe science and trust data and other things. You have it back there in the US. Out here, we also grappled with that in the early days of this pandemic. Many people were quite doubtful, but we have been able to provide the much needed insight they need, providing science, providing available data to ensure that everybody believes that indeed COVID-19 is rare and is a rare and present danger against which we must all guard. Apart from that, His Excellency President Biu has led by example. So we are trying to promote role modeling. Those in positions of trust at every level should set the example for the rest of their followership to believe in and to practice. So yes, we had those misgivings, those reservations, but by and large, we've been able to win more converts to believe that indeed COVID is real, COVID exists, and through a process of role modeling, we have been able to win even on believing Thomases to believe that indeed this is a real and present danger that we must present ourselves from.
Mohamed, some Sierra Leoneans also say that it was evident that some people refused to wear the mask, even though there have been education campaigns launched across the country to help sensitize Sierra Leoneans about the need to protect themselves, practice social distancing, wear masks, wash their hands frequently, or use hand sanitizers, among other medical measures outlined by your administration. Talk to me about this concern.
We all know that this is a change management challenge. It's initially resisted. We note that one of the very available, low-cost, high-impact measures we have to manage the COVID-19 is to ensure that we all remain masked at all times, we maintain social distancing, and over and above all, we practice unrelenting hand-washing hygiene. These are the things we have been preaching out to our citizens, and by and large, they seem to be conceding that. Just today, the NACOVAC leadership, particularly the risk communications and public outreach, have been going from office to office to engage the leadership of ministries, departments, and agencies to see reason to enforce, rigorously enforce, and where possible, take disciplinary actions against staff of ministries, departments, and agencies who do not imbibe the culture of wearing masks at all times. It's also been agreed that at all public functions, we will spare some time to discuss COVID-19. This is to ensure that everybody picks up the habit of masking, respecting social distancing, and practice proper hand washing hygiene practices.
And moving forward, how is your government determined or plan to contain the second wave, particularly those who are entering the shores of Sierra Leone, not only from the West, but also from neighboring countries using the country's borders?
So we note that by and large, this was an imported situation. When we had our index case in March last year, we knew we had to establish frontiers. We knew we had to be vigilant at entry ports. So already you are aware that we have one of the most robust measures to get into Sierra Leone from the international airport. You have to obtain a PCR negative as a license, as a passport to get into Sierra Leone. And once here, you are subject to an RDT test. If it shows negative, you are let into the country, but a PCR test is still done so that after 24 hours, you will be contacted. That is why in recent past, we maintain custody of your passport so that we are able to trace and track you once we get your PCR results out. I mean, that's what we're doing. We're extending rapid testing to the other land borders across the country because we note some people, because of our very rigorous scrutiny at the airport, might decide to use other ports of entry. We just want to make sure that there's no hiding place for anybody. There are no escape routes because President Bill treats the lives and livelihood of Sierra Leoneans as a key priority of his administration.
Mohamed Rahman Soare is the Sierra Leonean Information Minister. He spoke with me from the capital, Freetown. The World Food Programme is scaling up food assistance to tens of thousands of people displaced by intercommunal violence in Sudan's explosive Darfur region. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
United Nations agencies say an estimated 250 people have been killed and more than 100,000 forced to flee their homes following violent clashes between the Arab and Masalit tribes in mid-January in West and South Darfur. The UN's World Food Programme reports around 70,000 of the displaced are gathered in more than 70 centers across El Janina, the capital of West Darfur. Agency spokesman Thompson Fury says people are in a weakened condition, many suffering from moderate or acute malnutrition. He says the WFP has begun an emergency food distribution program, which so far has managed to reach 40,000 people in 30 of these centers.
Assistance is comprised of the staple, sorghum. We are also providing pulses and salt to enable people to make meals, as well as high-energy biscuits, which provide immediate nutrition for children and adults without the need for water or cooking.
He notes most people are subsistence farmers and depend on tilling the soil for their livelihoods. He says the period between November and January is the winter planting season and the main millet and sorghum harvesting season.
Even a momentary burst of violent disruption of livelihood activities can have a long-lasting impact. If a planting or a harvesting period is missed, it may not be resumed. If livestock cannot be moved to pasture or water, they may not survive.
The WFP is joining other agencies in renewing calls for an end to the violence in Darfur. It warns the fighting is having a severe adverse effect on the local population, and if it continues, food shortages and hunger will grow. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Hello, this is James Barton, Managing Editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest Africa news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Or you can call us on 001-202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. That's Daybreak Africa at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC, right here on VOA Africa. We'll be right back.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. But first, in Nigeria, the chairman of the Committee on Federal Character Commission says the organization is working with institutions of the federal administration and local governments to create jobs for the youth. Senator Danjuma Lah also says he is coordinating with institutions across the country to ensure the effective implementation of the group's policies. This, he says, will create the enabling environment for innovation and job creation aimed at reducing youth unemployment. This, after analysts blame the growing insecurity in the country to militant groups including Boko Haram. They also say unemployed youth could be easily persuaded to join the militant. To learn more about the government's effort to employ more Nigerian youth, I reached Senator Danjuma Lah, chairman for the Committee on Federal Character Commission.
We check around to be sure all policies that we're supposed to adopt by getting all the ministries to know those that are retired, those that have been retrenched, and those that have withdrawn their services voluntarily. We make sure that all those places have been occupied for the people seeking for job and the graduates that have been roaming around the street without something doing. We try to check where all provision in the budget has been met. Meet with those ministries to be assured they are going to advertise or to seek clearance from the federal character for such waiver to be given to them to do employment for those seeking for employment in the country, irrespective of all ministries, the whole country. That's what we're up to.
Why has it been that it's been a challenge for the federal government, or for that matter, including the state government, to create jobs for Nigeria's youth? Because youth advocates have said that a lot of graduates come out of Nigerian universities but are unemployed and they are idle. And that is where the danger lies. Do you think their concerns are legitimate?
Certainly it's not. The reason is because, you know, most people that are supposed to be retired are when you don't normally be retired, because most of them continue to hide their ages. Check through their data, some will be reducing their age terms, and you will not be able to know when someone is willing to retire. The moment supposed to occupy the position, he doesn't want anybody to know when to be retired. That makes the whole issue cumbersome. And also, the economy of the country is completely going down. And many people are finding it very difficult in trying to absorb all the graduates that are roaming the street instead of advertising their position to get the float. And many people are all struggling for their children without thinking of what other people will do. And people take it as if it is right, it is just for Buster A to be in another position without Buster B having it.
So, Senator Lah, there have also been concerns about insecurity in your state. Talk to me about ways you are helping your governor to help address this major concern.
Certainly, issue of security has been a bigger problem in the country, not just in my state alone. I have been looking through in all aspects to see where we can cope up with the situation. But as a matter of fact, we've done all we can, leaving the rest to God. God is doing his best, and the security of the country as well, the army more especially, are doing very, very well, tremendously, working very hard to curtail and to reduce these bandits and kidnappers all over the country.
I understand Kaduna State has a thriving ginger farming business. Talk to me about it and how you think you can be of help to create jobs for the youth.
Certainly, ginger farming in Kaduna, especially in my senatorial district, is the most beautiful farming that I do hope, by taking into consideration, to reduce a great number of the unemployment that we have in the southern part of Kaduna. Our ginger in the southern part of Kaduna is the most, the best, and is the great, beautiful, and more potential in the whole country. If you are looking for the ginger, our own is grade one in the whole country, if possible, in the whole world. We are looking forward to see those can come to create factories where this ginger can be supplied, and make sure that by getting all this factory done, certainly employment will be completely reduced to the barest minimum. And I'm looking forward to get our people involved by inviting foreigners to come and trade with us here, directly or indirectly, to enable us to provide them with all the needful things for them to have by getting this ginger at the input of the farmers, which can be able to provide the great number they want directly, instead of going to either third or fourth party supplier.
Senator Danjuma Lah is the chairman of the Committee on Federal Character Commission. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. Meanwhile, a number of school girls kidnapped by Boko Haram terrorists from a government school in Chibok, Nigeria, 7 years ago, have escaped captivity. For VOA, Timothy Obiezu reports from the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
An unknown number of girls are believed to have escaped after the military launched an offensive in the Sambisa forest in Borno State, the Boko Haram base where the girls and many other kidnapped victims are believed to be held. One of the girls, Halima Ali Meyanga, spoke to her father today from military custody, confirming the escape. Former chairman of the Chibok community, Hosea Adama, speaking to VOA via a messaging app, says the town is celebrating the news.
People are happy now. Yes, it is true. Even one, the whole village will jubilate over it.
The Nigerian military is yet to respond to questions or issue any statements on the matter. But Adama says the military is profiling the rescued victims to ascertain how many of them are Chibok girls who would now be in their late teens and early 20s.
Up to now, we don't know who is involved and how many. Even the soldiers, people contacted them, but they don't have information that they are still profiling.
In 2014, Boko Haram militants raided a government secondary school in Chibok town and kidnapped 276 girls. Dozens of the girls escaped soon after, and about 100 of them were freed through negotiations between 2016 and 2017. Hosea says five of his nieces are among the Chibok girls who are yet to be found. He's hoping they're among the new batch of returnees. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's start in Cameroon at the African Nations Championships, CHAN. The Eagles of Mali stopped Congo in penalties to storm the semi-final stage on Saturday. After a goalless draw in 120 minutes, Mali won 5-4 in penalties at the Ahmadou Ahidjo Stadium in Yaoundé. It is the second time Mali get to the semi-final stage of a CHAN tournament after finishing as runners-up in 2016. Host Cameroon also qualified for the semi-finals after beating tournament favourites DR Congo 2-1 on Saturday. Cameroon booked their first ever semi-final ticket. DR Congo's Leopards were searching for a third title success at CHAN. Joining Mali and Cameroon in the semi-finals will be the winner between Morocco and Zambia and the winner between Guinea and Rwanda. Still in football, Madagascar's Ahmed has been dramatically restored as the Confederation of African Football CAF president following a ruling by the Court of Arbitration for Sports. Ahmed was banned by FIFA in November for 5 years after football's world governing body found him to have breached several of its ethics codes. Ahmed is still ineligible to contest CAF's presidential elections in March. However, since the court's decision came after both CAF's and FIFA's review committees sat last week to approve candidates' eligibility, Ahmed will now resume his role as the FIFA vice president. He's also appealing his ineligibility to contest the March elections. His appeal will be heard on March 2nd. So far, there are four candidates cleared to run for the CAF elections in Morocco on March 12th. They are Jacques Anouma of Ivory Coast, Patrice Masepe of South Africa, Augustin Senghor of Senegal, and Ahmed Yahia of Mauritania. And in boxing, the mega fight for the undisputed heavyweight boxing champion may finally go ahead without Anthony Joshua losing his WBO title, as Joe Joyce is being lined up to dispute the WBO interim heavyweight title with Alexander Usyk. This fight will clear the way for Tyson Fury and Anthony Joshua to fight for all four major world heavyweight titles in their next fight. Joyce, with 12 wins, 11 of them coming by way of knockouts, knocked out Daniel Dubois last month and is now number two in the WBO rankings behind Usyk, the former undisputed world cruiserweight champion. Usyk, with 18 wins and 13 knockouts, beat Derek Chisora on points in October. The 31-year-old Anthony Joshua is the current WBA, IBF, and WBO champion with 24 wins, 1 loss, and 11 of those wins coming by way of knockouts, while his English rival Tyson Fury, who is 32, has 30 wins, no loss, 1 draw, and 20 wins by way of knockout, and he holds the WBC title. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Kitafuna niweke mdomoni kila ukisema geto liwe VIP lipame kwa mishuma ongeza upole wako bema kwa usini uni usije niacha mazima mama mwazako chizi wa mapezi usini mbukuzi ukaja kupata lawa mawala. Maya kasa ukikosa papa samaki nipati engisi saya ni nilimwata na nimekwisha apa wengine hawana nafasi mbeni safisha nilipochafuka wawaisi kwa ashi mini kuku Tapada, vishe suti martini kadida. Ongeza upole wako bema kwa usini uni, usije niacha mazima mama. Mwazako chizi wa mapezi, usini mkuzi, ukaja kupata lawama mwana. Mbeni safisha nilipochafuka. Oh, if you're busy,
I tell your mama, tell your mama and your papa, tell your sister and your brother. Baby girl, what make me lose it? I don't wanna lose it. Not ready for you.
She would know, my day, mama, come on, boom. run at your fan. Unfuni ne dama koma so. Girl, I wanna love you to the end of time. Me up on the cross to trim my son. Yeah, so don't be surprised if I kill myself all in the name of love. Me and I'm a bad pair, will let me pay the price. So I dream, you see me team while I'm a fill with rough. Beauty lies in the eyes of beholder. Oh, home to girl, I'm sober. And kind of life, and I'm chasing my daughter when it's over. To see, I'm irresponsible. Me bomb, my a soldier. Jaina, woman, kind of win me, Brian, I'll be a soldier. Can be betrayed.
go vex. Touch me, I got you. Man, no go vex.
That was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoyed the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, Managing Editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, only the one who walks on burning coals could feel it. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.